Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 24th of May. Very nice to have you with us on the program. I thank you for being with us. It's always a pleasure to be in your company and for you to think enough of us to turn the dial or to ask your smart speaker to put us on or however you get us downloading us later to listen in a podcast form. However you get us, we are happy about that, and we thank you for being here. Let me introduce our group to you. A reminder that if you'd like to be a part of the program, we have a lot of items to discuss. We have an amazing panel this morning, and we'll talk about, you know, the same old boring issues, according to Jim Hendler.
Well, I'm leaving.
This is why Jim doesn't write our promotional copy. Today on the roundtable, we'll talk about the same old crap. We have amazing stories, and we'll talk about those with amazing people, and we welcome you, panel, at wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you. He is Tetherless World Chair of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences and Founding Director of the Future of Computing Institute at RPI, Jim Hendler. Good morning, sir.
And not boring.
Good morning. And I promise I won't be boring if I can help it.
You're never boring. Never, ever, ever boring. Thank you very much for being here. Judy Patrick joins us, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
And we welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Bob, good morning.
Hey, Joe. Good morning. Just a reminder, it's the one-year anniversary of the massacre at Uvalde, 19 students and two teachers. So just keep them in your thoughts, keep them in your prayers, and hug your kids.
Absolutely. We talked about that on Monday, and obviously it's still – they have a lot of questions and a lot of answers that we all – seek, and we do think about that this morning.
Not peppy, I know.
It's one of these things where those anniversaries, these incidents come day after day, and so do the anniversaries, unfortunately. And it reminds us, we just saw this in Buffalo. It's very sobering. We are thrilled to have the mayor of the city that we reside in, the city of Albany, New York. Kathy Sheehan is with us. Mayor, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you on the program. I'm always thrilled that you can make time for us. Well, I don't know how you make time for us, but I thank you for making time for us.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. It's always wonderful to sit here with other panelists and learn things and have the time to actually
hash out all this stuff.
Yeah, figure out how to solve all the world's problems.
Well, that's what we try to do each and every day here, and I don't know. Maybe we do, maybe we don't, but here we go. We have a lot to talk about. We welcome you, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. Let's begin by talking about, let's start with Kevin McCarthy and the debt limit. And this is a story that we have been talking about for a number of days, and we're sort of just waiting to see what happens. But the question is, how many defections will there be? McCarthy, who is bracing for defections, eyes a fraught path to a debt limit deal. Speaker McCarthy is attempting a difficult balancing act as he tries to extract spending concessions from President Biden in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, cobbling together a deal that can win the votes of a majority of Republicans without alienating the critical mass of Democrats he would need to push it through the House. Hard-right Republicans have fueled the debt limit standoff by demanding deep spending cuts at the price of averting a default, and they are all but certain to oppose any compromise. That means that Mr. McCarthy, a California Republican, would need the support of a solid block of Democrats in the closely divided chamber. The political reality is weighing on both the Republicans and the Democrats in the debt ceiling and the debt limit talks, which continued yesterday on Capitol Hill with no sign of imminent resolution. June 1st is
next
the deadline that they seem to be working with, and yes, that is next week. Mr. McCarthy and Mr. Biden are weighing compromises that would likely result in losing the votes of both the hard left and right flanks in Congress, meaning they would need to assemble a coalition of Republicans and centrist Democrats to back any final deal to avert a default. That from the New York Times. Mayor, what do you make of this?
Well, my husband did say this morning, I am so sick and tired of hearing about the debt ceiling. But, you know, I think it's not lost on me that this is money that has already been spent and that the opposition to dealing with this issue is being led by a party that drove up record deficits when they had the White House and control. So it's just, you know, look, we've got to pay our bills. And this is money that they've already spent. And we talk about the budget when it's time to talk about the budget. And so I think that many people are tired of hearing about this. There is a way to get this resolved. It is a challenge, but I do get the sense that McCarthy understands that. And I think that that is one of the reasons that they're talking. But how does he get, you know, his party in line to vote for something that the president can sign is you know, another issue. But this is money we've already spent. And it's money that's been spent by Democratic, you know, administrations and Republican administrations. And to tie that to what we're going to be funding in the future and what we're going to be doing with respect to getting spending in line are two completely separate issues. I think the president's right on this. But, you know, this is where we are. Nobody's listening to sort of the reason and rationale. They're going for headlines and, you know, playing this out on social media.
Bob?
Yeah, it's interesting to me to see whether whether McCarthy will be able to pull together a centralist vote. It's going to be interesting to watch what happens with the interplay between him and Jeffries. I'm also wondering how soon after any vote is taken that there's a vote of no confidence, because I'm assuming that that's what the Freedom Caucus and the far right is lining him up for. It was also interesting today to hear Bob Good and some of the other members of the really far right elements in the House start questioning. Well, you know, the June 1st, that may not be the right date. As if we can continue with the this is the financial equivalent of the O.J. Simpson, you know, white Bronco police chase. It's just like it has to end at some point. It is. I agree with your husband, Mayor. Just do something.
Do your jobs.
Yeah. Exactly. It's creating, I think it's already starting to create a drag on people's, creating a drag on the economy. It certainly has hurt us. We don't talk a lot about the international implications of the fact that we can't decide whether we're going to pay our bills or not. But it's something that's being played up by both Russia and China right now. So we're getting hurt on the international. We're getting hurt on the national. Certainly, it doesn't help the economy. And as people are trying to head into summer, it's something that they honestly they just don't need hanging over their head.
Jim?
Yeah, you know, I guess what I really find challenging on all this is people elected a set of Republican representatives who ran on destroying the government. Literally. I mean, they said the federal government's a bad thing. We should get rid of it, right? And now we're surprised that that same group is not terribly concerned about the debt ceiling, right? They want to care about, you know, their strange issues in terms of some of them space lasers and things like that. I mean, so I'm not even just talking about right wing, left wing. It's the very, very right, very, very left. And they're not really equivalent just because the strength right now of that right is so much stronger than the strength of that left. And I think McCarthy's going to have to come up with a deal that has two pieces to it, right? One which gets him through this, and two, some of those Democrats who vote for whatever bipartisan thing will have to agree that they would support him in a run for, you know, when if the MAGA side challenges his leadership, they have to have majority vote. The reason we had 15 votes last time was there was no one else who was challenging him. All it takes is a few Democratic votes to move onto his side, and that can quiet down the MAGA group. And so, you know, it's conceivable that this deal could include that, but that requires a rationality that we're just not seeing at the moment.
Obviously, at least in public. Yes, that's right. Obviously, Judy, I mean, this is an old movie, which is, you know, we've seen it over and over and over again, which is when, you know, we're sick and tired of hearing about the debt ceiling. But you could almost write the stories, which is today is like, we're seeing a glimpse. A glimmer of hope. The door has been open. We're positive. Oh, we're taking a step back. No meaningful talks. It just goes on and on and on. And I assume we'll have that until June 1st or maybe after.
And the danger is they'll do a two-week extender.
Yeah.
And so we'll be talking about this into July. It's all about it's all about perception, don't you think? It's, you know, the president coming back from his Asian trip early to work on this. I actually think that perhaps the president is trying to help McCarthy get there, because at one point, I think it was late Sunday night or Monday night, where McCarthy is saying, no, things are not going wrong. Well, they probably were, but, you know, they come out with these nuanced opinions about what's going on, and trying to move the needle one way or the other. I think both sides have to come to an agreement that gives them the appearance of victory. They're talking about, you know, leveling off discretionary spending. Let's hope that's not across the board, because that's really going to hurt education spending, infrastructure spending. I think they're holding spending flat essentially is a cut in the age of, 8 or 9% inflation. So there's, you know, concern from the left that these kinds of cuts will really have a significant impact. I agree with everybody about, you know, the debt should be separate from a budget. But back in the day when I would send reporters out to write about local budgets, I said, do not call them spending plans, because they're not. It's not just expenditures. There's a revenue side of every budget, and that's when we discuss it. And even in the revenue side, there's always a debt portion of the budget. So budgets are not just spending plans. Debts are revenue plans as well.
You know, and Joe, if I could connect two comments that were made. You know, part of the question I have is, does Kevin McCarthy just want to be, is it more important for him to be speaker, or does he want to be a leader? And so far, he hasn't shown me anything other than that he will sell his soul to be speaker and to be in that office, rather than someone who actually wants to lead the country. And you know, Jim, you raised an interesting point that links with Judy's comment, is that because of the way Congress is set right now, there is a very vocal, crazy minority that is holding the country hostage. And at some point, the GOP, or both the GOP and the Democrats, have got to decide that they're going to put them in a corner, and they should do what should have been done from the very beginning, and ignore them and take them off of committees. But right now, they are over empowered. I listened to the 2 week, Judy, and I think, you know, they benefit, the far right benefits from a 2 week, because it's just a game to them, and they are making statements that I think they firmly believe that we can survive by not paying our bills, that we can go in default. It's not going to be that bad. And, you know, and I guess when you have the sweet benefit packages that they have, and you know, they've got their campaign war chest that they can fall back on, that they misuse, that, you know, yeah, because they're not going to suffer the way the rest of us do.
Well, and interestingly, I think I heard on this program Janet Yellen pointing out that this is actually really hard to do. The systems are set up to pay bills on time. And she talked about millions of checks being cut every day. And so figuring out what you don't pay and figuring out how to do that is no small task. And I imagine that they're working on that right now in anticipation of having to make those types of decisions. And I agree with you. There are folks who have been elected to office who truly don't care whether or not our entire system shuts down, whether people are harmed, whether other countries are harmed. They don't care.
I'm going to go further than that. I think it's not even that they don't care. It's that they're okay with it and maybe even in favor of it. It fits their political belief in essentially crashing things so we can rebuild the country in the right-wing mold that they want. And
even Matt Gaetz had a quote yesterday that said something to the effect of, you don't negotiate with the hostage. Yeah. So he's saying it out loud. Leading, I imagine, is very difficult. Being speaker with a nice office and all the perks is probably enjoyable. But I imagine leading is not easy. There's a lot of very sleepless nights. So
I'm glad you lifted that up, because I'm sure he was probably envisioning Joe Biden as the hostage. But it's us.
That's absolutely right.
We are seen by an individual with a tremendous amount of power as his hostages.
That's the part that you have to wrap your brain around.
You've rendered a politician speechless. you can tell it.
We're gonna take a break. When we come back, I'm sure everyone will regain the ability to talk about these issues. And I welcome you to join us. Share your thoughts. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We ask you to keep your letters short and to the point, and that way we can get to as many as possible. And please, no links, because I can't open them and they shut down my computer. Okay. We welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org. We will be back right after this news. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us for this conversation. We have Judy Patrick, we have Jim Henler, Bob Griffin, and the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. I was looking up, because I said mayor earlier, and then I realized, what is the proper way to address the mayor? And this is, you tell me if this is right. This is from, Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. Mayor, or Mayoress, or Madam Mayoress.
Oh my God. I like what they call mayors in Ireland, which is Lord Mayor.
Yes.
Yes.
I like that too.
I really like that.
I like that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you and I should be able to get away with that. So what do you want?
It doesn't really matter.
No, I didn't ask that. What do you want?
You can call me Kathy on this show.
Okay.
Some people refer to me as mayor. Right. I don't stand on ceremony.
Mayor so. Kathy. All right. See, these are the things I lose sleep over. You know, I was just like, oh, I hope I don't get this wrong. All right. We welcome you, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Let's go to some of the letters that we have on this subject. Vesta says, it's always the Republicans that threaten to shove us over the fiscal cliff. John Faso said Trump negotiated with Pelosi, but Nancy Pelosi never threatened this level of brinkmanship. Pelosi also can count votes, and it is unclear how many votes Kevin has, and no matter what the deal. Trump is making his noises to let default happen, yet said the debt shouldn't be questioned when it was raised 3 times and ballooned to 25% during his tenure. Republicans might be playing their hand that Democrats and Biden would be blamed for the result of a trashed economy.
Yep. And that gets back to this whole idea that this becomes a game. And this, I think, is one of the more serious issues with the whole culture in D.C. right now, is that A lot of people go there and they forget what's important because it becomes the power and the trappings and the gotchas and the winning at every cost, including what's best for the country, including what's best for their own constituents. Yeah. But you know something, Joe? We have members of Congress in our own region that continue to vote against bills. They take full credit for things like the infrastructure bill, but they voted against it. And they're in party leadership positions. I don't need to name her, but I think you know who I'm talking about.
It rhymes with raphonic.
But it doesn't seem like a very astute, politically good long game. Because if the economy sours when the debt ceiling is not raised, whoever is responsible for it is going to lose at the polls, you would think.
Yeah, but the question becomes the perception. Right. Okay, so I think back to when we had the government shutdown under Clinton. Right. It was the same brinkmanship. And what was really waiting to be seen was who was going to get the blame. The minute it became clear the Republicans were being blamed, they changed the game. Right. And I think if Clinton had been getting the game, getting the blame, you'd have seen it differently. Here, what scares me is in the short term, I do think the Republicans will be blamed. But if they weather that, looking a year down the road at the effects of this thing, that's going to be economy. An economy is always blamed on the president. And it's going to be really hard a year from now for the president to say, but they did it a year ago.
And Judy, I think this also shows the problem with gerrymandering, okay, is that the districts have been gerrymandered so badly that someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't have to worry about competition. Okay, you look at what's happened in Florida, what they've done in North Carolina. What they've done is that they have stripped all of the power from the urban areas, and that's why you see these super red majority, because they've disenfranchised the people because they've gerrymandered so badly that they can get away with this garbage, and they don't have to worry about it.
Well, but when you can't make Social Security payments. And you can't pay Medicare because you've not extended the debt ceiling. I think I'm just waiting for the day that at some point people start to say, we need you to do your jobs. And back to my do your jobs. I mean, you know, we have things that we do care about that need to get done, whether you're Democrat or Republicans. The Republicans want things to get done in Washington. They do want to see changes. And we have seen now from the Trump presidency to what we're seeing now, where I know everything that they're against and I don't know a single thing that they're for.
Do you have meetings in your office as to how this is going to affect the city, how it's going to affect?
We're very concerned. One of the things that they're talking about as a compromise is to pull back the rescue plan funding that isn't spent. Now, what does that mean? Ours is all allocated. We've allocated it, but we gave out, we provided $25 million in grants to various projects across the city that the intention was to spread that out over that money out over 3 years. Yeah. So if we don't actually have the cash out the door, but it's obligated, would that be part of a sweep or would it not be part of a sweep? So, yeah, mayors are paying attention to this because it does certainly have an impact on the spending plans that we currently have in place. If there is a sweep, if there is, you know, I look at Albany County, they're still in the process of figuring out how they're going to allocate a pretty significant portion of their ARPA funding. They're going through a process and that money is at risk.
That's every village, town, county in the country. I mean,
right.
Small little towns, small little villages are getting substantial amount. Or we're supposed to get substantial amount of money. I don't know whether that will happen or not. But it's right when they talk about clawing back that money.
Right.
That may very well be what is affected.
And that's really important because you think about the terminology clawing back as if the money is being wasted or not being used correctly. When in reality, it's the process and these are sort of it's built-in inefficiencies in the federal government that they don't push money quickly normally because there aren't safeguards. So in order to put the safeguards in place, it takes them a long time to move the money or to give the parameters to communities who then have got to jump through all of those hoops. But when people say, well, you know, you haven't spent it, that's silly. Of course, that's an easy, that's a low-hanging fruit. What the mayor didn't say, and I want to make sure we're connecting this, is that those are bids that the city is not going to be able to put out to the private industry in order to get paid to do work, who will hire people to do that work, who will get paid, who will then go and put that money back into the economy in things like buying homes or upgrading their appliances or buying cars. That's where the insidious impact of this becomes such a drag on the overall national economy. It doesn't happen overnight, but when it does, it's sort of like the hardening of the arteries in your heart, and when a heart attack comes, it's bad.
Preach, Bob, preach.
Thank you.
I was actually getting back to the gerrymandering and all that. You know, again, I think this is all playing into each other because right now you have people in the Republican Party who the only thing they're scared of is being sent out of office by someone who's more right-wing than they are, right? They don't have a Democratic opposition because of the gerrymander. And that's, you know, pushing things further apart. Some number of years ago, I saw Bill Bradley, and, you know, we were already talking about this stuff, and this must have been 15 years ago. And he said, you know, until you see a real crisis, right, you're not going to see a middle come. And what used to happen, he said, when he started in Congress, there were 30 people who were the swing votes. Now, he said, now it's down to 5. Now we're down to, you know, 2 or 3. And that's really, I think, causing the problem. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the Senate yet, right? What happens when this stuff gets up there? And, you know, they're saying that if it passes, if something is approved by the House, they'll pass it. But again, it's gonna if it's as radical as what the right wing wants right now, I don't see the Democratic Senate being terribly excited by it.
Here's a letter from Andrew who says, yes, I'm tired of hearing about the debt ceiling as well. But what I'm actually tired of is how you're covering it. As mentioned a few times, we the people have absolutely no control over how these extremists act, and we've had no control over how these idiots act while in office for the last 7 years, aside from trying to vote them out in the interim. So listening to you continuing to clutch your proverbial pearls ad nauseum is exhausting. Instead of whining about it, change the topic to things that we the people can do to prepare for a full-on default. If we're going to be held hostage, then let's at least talk about how we can fully prepare for the apocalypse that you all keep moaning about.
Wow. You should have him on the show. Or her.
Well, I mean, Andrew, you know, having 3 weeks of food and things like dry beans and canned goods is always good.
Get Bob and the tuna.
If you want instructions on how to deal with the apocalypse, I'm more than happy to give it. But I'm sorry, I was clutching my pearls too tightly.
I think in all seriousness, it is important for people to know and understand the practicality of what this means and things that you should be prepared for. When I mentioned Social Security and Medicare, I meant it. So right. For those of you who are relying on Social Security, you need to think about what is your financial position, what is your credit ability, how much savings do you have? You know, these are all things that people need to absolutely be thinking about. And when you think about the challenges that we have in our healthcare system now, if you have that healthcare system now having their payments delayed or potentially, you know, new charges not even going to be in the queue to get paid, that is going to impact your ability to access healthcare. So, you know, if you have something that's bothering you right now, you should probably try to get to the doctor this week. And I'm not being a jerk. It's like these are the real things that could be impacted when if this debt ceiling issue is not dealt
and,
with.
And I think what hard to explain, you know, when you look at just numbers, when you look at just economic, I think it was on Monday's show, Faso was saying how, look, we have all these people out of work, and so we should have this 20-hour work requirement. And I'm sitting there going, like, you know, the people who are out of work aren't living in the same places where the jobs are going unfilled. So either figure out a way you're going to move people around, so, you know, get somebody down from urban Albany out to rural Washington County is not non-trivial, right? The same thing's going to happen with this. It's going to hit different people in different ways at different times. First, it's going to hit at kind of a high economic level, right? It's going to cause stock market craziness and things like that. And that's not going to, you know, it's not going to be immediately obvious how that impacts your check. If it goes on for a month, 2 months, that's when I think the Social Security checks and things like that. But so you know, it's going to come in ripples and they're going to hit different people. And it's really hard to say what's going to happen. So I think part of why we're saying, you know, I don't know whether to go with Bob's advice and stock up the wine cellar or
I don't know whether to do it or just to go over to Bob's. Yeah, that's sort of what I'm thinking. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more letters and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Trying to find a balance, trying not to tip the scales, just trying to make some sense of what it all meant.
Oh, trying to make sense of what it all meant. Yes, indeed. That's what we're doing here on the roundtable this morning. Bridget St. John providing the music, UK-born, US-based folk singer and songwriter. Going to be at the Dreamaway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts on Thursday, June 1st, and on Saturday, June 3rd at Tubby's in Kingston, New York. And again, Bridget St. John, if you go to the WAMC.org/roundtable website, you can see the playlist listed there of all the tracks that we've been playing this morning. We welcome you to join in with our terrific group this morning. We have Jim Hendler, Bob Griffin, Judy Patrick, and Kathy Sheehan, and we welcome you. Kevin writes, the usual question of where are the young people in political protest should be revised to where are the boomers most likely to be immediately and long-term impacted by a crash. A million boomer march. Let's go.
All right. It's been 50 years since a cop hit me with a stick. I'm ready.
It's been 50 years since a cop hit me with a stick.
You know, I'd be interested.
Actually, 45.
I'd be interested to see how many calls any of these congresspeople are actually getting in their offices, and whether the phones are silent or whether or not they're ringing off the hook.
Well, I suspect,
I suspect the phones are silent. I don't think this is an issue that people are calling about.
Well, Elizabeth writes and says, if Social Security has its own fund, why do they keep saying they won't be able to pay recipients if the government, quote, runs out of money?
That is a Republican talking point. They do have their own fund, and the first batch of checks is supposed to go out on June 2nd. But the argument is if they can't pay one thing, they shouldn't be able to pay any of them. Am I understanding that?
Well, and I think it is all about how do you then take your cash and prioritize your debt.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's going to be the issue.
Casey writes to us. Were you going to say something?
It also becomes a challenge because everything will go to courts. Go to the courts as people try to become higher up on the list of who gets what. So it's a very long process.
Go ahead.
We can even get it. Well, if you want to get Bob and I really geeking, we'll start talking about the national security aspects of this and the homeland security aspects. I mean, this thing really has tentacles into virtually everything. And I think people just, you're right, they're ignoring it. But it's because even if you sort of have been involved and understand this stuff, it's still hard to understand. And even, you know, I've talked to colleagues who are like government macro economists, and they're still trying to guess what impact this is going to have internationally. I mean, it's hard to say. It's never happened.
Casey writes to us and says, the political gamemanship that is currently plaguing Washington over the debt ceiling is another example of why so many Americans distrust Congress and elected officials. As a young person, it has become increasingly difficult to engage my peers when they, rightfully so, are exhausted and disenfranchised by the process. This is shameful.
But that's the exact result that these individuals are hoping for. So disenfranchise people, make them feel as if their voice doesn't matter, and they gain power and strength because the people that they're catering to, pandering to, some would say, are the ones who are involved and who do get out and vote. And so the more you can disenfranchise younger people, people who are, you know, looking at this with a sense of hopelessness, not understanding it, you know, that's their exact goal. And I think this is something that people should be calling about. And, you know, there, when there are no voices on the other side, you leave a vacuum for extremists. And that's, I believe, what we are seeing right now at this inflection point in time in our country.
Dave writes, the work of Congress to solve the debt crisis is always compared to managing the family budget. However, what's missing is a realistic description of the situation. In truth, the budget planning should be described as a family trying to reconcile the fact that for the past 4 years, the dad had decided not to put his entire paycheck into the family bank account, keeping a big chunk of it for himself to pay for a speedboat, trips to the islands, and maybe even an apartment for his mistress. Americans ought to wake up and recognize that Republican priorities are all utterly selfish and self-serving. Then we go to Joel. The MAGA hostage takers are domestic terrorists and should be dealt with as such. Paying the ransom is not the way. Robert writes, what the mayor says is incorrect. This is not money that has been spent. This is money that has been committed, much of it by Democrats at the last minute, with the hope of it being rammed through as part of a budget compromise.
I'm sorry. Is the letter writing referring to raising the debt ceiling? Because the debt ceiling is for money that has
it's debt,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think this becomes part of the challenge is that current spending and debt become intertwined in this, and the temptation is to simplify this complex national economy as if it's the simplicity of our home economies, which most of us have trouble with even our home economies. This thing is way more complex than that.
Right, it's money we probably spent 20, 30, 40 years ago on bridges or on defense spending.
Well, tax
breaks. In the city, we try to maintain that no more than 10% of our operating budget goes to paying debt. But if we have an emergency, if we have something that occurs that requires us to borrow money, we have to take that money from our operating budget, right, and put it towards paying that debt. That means that's money that we can't spend on parks, on police, on fire. So, yeah, it is inextricably linked, and it gets very complex having to figure out what decisions are you going to make. And we've all faced them at the local level. You know, can we afford to do our summer youth employment program, or are we going to pay this bill? And we can't default on our debt. And so, or if we do, it really has even more repercussions for the future. Your borrowing costs go up, all kinds of things happen. So, you know, that's the scenario. That's why we are sort of talking about operating expenditures, because how are you going to make sure that you pay that debt?
But there is a fundamental difference, though, right, Mayor, that you are legally required to have a balanced budget. You have to have a balanced budget.
Correct.
The federal government isn't required to have a balanced budget. So there's a, you know, there's people go, well, you know, the states are required to have a balanced budget. The federal government has run a long time with not having to have a balanced budget. And there are some legitimate reasons for that, including things like national security, that there are whole elements of what we spend in certain areas that that are considered to be black budgets, and that you don't know what it is, because we don't want places like China or Russia or Iran knowing where we're putting money. So that it again, there are levels of complexity at the federal government that the state and localities don't have the same flexibility, freedom, or responsibility.
Couple letters to finish up this segment as we eye a break at the top of the hour. Alan writes, please stop conflating extreme left with extreme right. They are not the same. The extreme left want good health care for all and free college. The extreme right want to burn us all to the ground and hate black, brown, and queer people. Please give me a break already, writes Alan. Then we go to this letter from Tom. Will I get my Social Security check? Well, those who need it more than I get theirs. We've already given the government our Social Security money and have entrusted the government to take good care of it. Why is the defense budget off the table? The military-industrial complex demands that it be so. Why are tax increases on the filthy rich off the table? The government's fiduciary responsibility to the citizenry is the problem to solve by working around partisanship and lobbyists with deep, deep pockets. That from Tom. We go to...
You do get better justice if you pay for justices' kids to go to school or grandkids or buy their house or take on expensive
great
trips.
Nephews, Bob.
Great nephews. I'm sorry. I was clutching
Bob
my pearls too tightly.
Bob
there,
was
Joe.
Being hypothetical.
Yes.
That's right.
The list is so long, Joe. I'm sure I could have fit it in eventually.
I know there was a yacht in there somewhere, yeah.
Bruce writes, the press is a co-conspirator with our politicians by the relentless coverage of this drummed-up debt limit crisis. The politicians play voters for fools, pretending they are digging in to deal with the crisis. But let's be honest, who created this crisis in the first place? The politicians. The press should just call it what it is, a drummed-up crisis, and report on how politicians play on voter sentiments to add their campaign coffers while pretending to be hard at work to serve their constituents when, in fact, they created the crisis in the first place. Give us a break. We're not as stupid as you would make us out to be. I don't know. That letter seems to contradict itself. But my question is, if you have Janet Yellen saying that this can be detrimental to us by June 1st, and other economists looking at this, the Wall Street being spooked, I mean, that what's being drummed up there?
Exactly. It's the press is covering what's happening. I haven't heard anyone other than far-right extremists say that, well, this is no big deal, we'll survive this. What I've seen is substantial coverage of exactly what is going to happen, a timeline of this is going to happen on June 2nd, this is going to happen on June 10th, this is what's going to happen to the federal interest rate, this is what's going to happen to the cost to borrow money. I mean, I've seen significant coverage about what could happen because there's a real concern that this may happen, and if it does, it could be a catastrophe. I don't see it being drummed up coverage. I see it being reliable.
But where the literator is correct, though, is that this is a totally unnecessary created crisis.
Yes.
Okay, the chicken that's being played with our financial well-being in our future is unnecessary. And if you think about it, three times during the Trump administration, clean debt ceiling bills were passed. So where the letter writer, you hit it right on the head. This is absolutely unnecessary.
All right. We're going to take a break there. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to new topics. Lots of other stuff to, scare you about and drum up, as it were. We'll be back right after this news with Ray Graff.
I love you. I need you. I feel you flying. I know I can hold you no more.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. An amazing group with us. Jim Hendler, Bob Griffin, Judy Patrick, and Mayor Kathy Sheehan. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind about the topics we discuss this morning. Let's go to, hey, you ready, Jim? Let's talk about social media. Let's talk about what the Surgeon General is warning us. And it's a fairly serious warning. The nation's top health official issued an extraordinary public warning on Tuesday about the risks of social media to young people, urging a push to fully understand the possible, quote, harm to the mental health and well-being of children and adolescents. In a 19-page advisory, the U.S. Surgeon General noted that the effects of social media on adolescent mental health were not fully understood, and that social media can be beneficial to some users. Nonetheless, he wrote, there are ample indicators that social media can also be a profound risk of harm to the mental health and well-being of children and adolescents. The report included practical recommendations to help families guide children's social media use. It recommended that families keep mealtimes and in-person gatherings free of devices to help build social bonds and promote conversation. And it suggested creating a family media plan to set expectations for social media use, including boundaries around content and keeping personal information private. Good luck. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I'm really torn on this issue because there's, if you go look at early days of television, and even not that long ago, right, 20 years back, you had these same kind of things. Limit your kid to 1 hour a day. Don't let them do it. But there was also the difference between, are you letting your kid watch Sesame Street, or are they watching something different? You know, nowadays, you know, I would say we should have rules that say no one's allowed to watch the news for more than 2 hours, and if it's Fox News, no more than 5 minutes, or pick your favorite other way of doing that. But again, so social media being talked about as if it's a thing is challenging because there's a lot of different social media. They have a lot of different aspects. But what I think is really going on here is the positive impacts don't have the economic incentives that the negative ones do. So what I mean by that is, okay, you take somebody who, you know, in TV or magazines would be a model. That person becomes an influencer on social media, suddenly has 1.5 million teenage girls watching her, right? They want to look like her. They want to be like her, right? You know, that's, quote, a channel, unquote, right? That's an unhealthy one because it's pushing body image, things like that. Now, there's other channels that are there. So, for example, you know, at a time when the conservative governments are cutting down on LGBTQ care and you know, trying to really the suicide rate in that group is exceedingly high. But actually, social media has brought that down if they can discover the places where there are support groups and things. So you have these different impacts, but one that helps people get better doesn't tend to generate money as much as one that has somebody holding a can of soda with their photo on it and therefore sells 8 million, you know, cans of that soda. Social influence, media influencers on TikTok, Instagram, things like that can make a huge amount of money. So it's the advertisers who are pushing which things will get the most views. And then once you have those views, that pushes more views. And so it's a very complicated thing. But you know, it's sort of painting with a very broad brush. I do agree with a lot of these recommendations that parents need to be much more aware of some of these impacts. I'm much more worried, for example, about some of the privacy impacts of this stuff, some of the data that's being collected on your kids, which in 15 or 20 years is going to impact what political ads they see, what they're being sold, what jobs they're going to get, what education will be directed towards them. You know, this is a big issue, and the Supreme Court has just decided last week to punt on the entire thing. Just say, you know, this is too complicated for us. You guys deal with it, and passed it back to Congress, which has been split on this for over 20 years. So, yes, there are these health issues. Yes, parents need to know what their kids are doing, but don't tarnish it as like saying all TV is bad. A lot of the right-wing stuff happened because of Rush Limbaugh on the radio.
Right.
So should we say radio is bad?
But I think the difference here is that parents don't have the ability to control it. And as a parent who worked very hard to figure out how can I block certain things, once your child has a smartphone, it's game over. And no matter what you think you might be doing, your child is still going to be able to access things. And so we keep talking about it's the parents' responsibility, it's the parents' responsibility, but we've made it technologically, and I think it's technologically possible, but it is, we are not giving parents the ability to control that. I mean, I remember my cable box had a timer set in it, so I could literally set the amount of time that my child could watch television, much to his regret. But I did that. You know, his phone was in our room every night. But again, that was it was that, or I had no control because there were no parental controls that I could put on that phone that would address what our kids are seeing, how they're being marketed to, and the messaging that is getting to them. And that's, I think, the frustrating thing for parents. And I think to his credit, you know, Dr. Murthy is saying, hey, folks,
Pay attention.
And if you are paying attention, you are going to have to make some of these decisions of just literally not being able to have access to the device because that's the only way to have control.
Well, yes, and educate, right? So the real problem is most adults have no clue what's going on TikTok, mm-hmm. right? As a result, you don't know what influence, you don't know, you know, with TV, you can sort of teach your child the difference between a news channel, a cartoon that's trying to sell them something, a cartoon that's just enjoyable, that sort of thing. We kind of understand that. On social media, it's not harder, but the kid, you know, what you've just said is your child has to become a smart consumer. Which means we, the adults, have to teach them how to be smart consumers. The problem is, how do we teach the kids how to be smart consumers is something which we don't understand. And so, frankly, my solution to this is to, and I agree with what he's saying here, is we need to raise awareness. 19-page documents full of health stuff is tricky. But on the other hand, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Okay, so a lot of teen suicides were caused by isolation. This kid was weird in their school. The other kids picked on them. Well, now that kid can go online and find a community. That has saved as many kids as Instagram and TikTok has caused negative health effects. And so the question is, how do we balance these things? How do we create an educational system that will reward the good stuff? Right? How do we an economic system? And that's really the problem, is it's been taken over by money.
And I may have misspoken because my child is now an adult, but that was my frustration in his early years. Maybe the technology has gotten better with parents' ability, parental controls. I keep hearing about it and Facebook talks about it, but I don't know whether, at least when I had a young person, none of those worked. I mean, it was either you had access or you didn't.
And I think it's actually worse, and I think the level of sophistication of some of the platforms is way exceeding our capacity to keep up with it. I'm also struck at some of the numbers that, and I did not read all 19 pages, and I was sort of smirking to myself that, you know, he did 19 pages what you could do in 180 characters.
ChatGPT.
You know, can't say it enough time. You know, and maybe part of the requirements for our K-12 education needs to be things like cyber hygiene, and really understanding, because, Jim, you put your finger on a couple of things that really worry me, that there's data collection going on right now that is going to haunt people through the rest of their lives. And for sort of us on the other side of the hill, all the stupid stuff that we did, or most of it, is you know, way in the past, and if there was a picture, you could burn the picture in the negative. The stuff that goes on now that is linked with somebody in their account stays with them the rest of their life. Was anybody else surprised at the number of hours that they were talking about? Fewer than 3 hours a day, I think, was that one of the recommendations? I remember seeing something about the amount of time spent on these platforms, and I was just trying to figure out how people got that much time to spend on one of the
studies that was done recently on how to get kids to more aimed at teenagers, but how to get them to start limiting some of this, self-limiting, right? Because, of course, telling them what to do is not necessarily the best way to deal with a teenager, helping them figure out what to do, is keep a log. And they were reporting on people who were discovering they were on social media 10, 11, 12 hours a day, right? And, you know, in class, they're sitting there looking at it. During breaks, they're looking at it. During the, you know, I mean, once it becomes this compulsion, you know, and someone, one of the young women in this story who was interviewed, this was a radio story, was had a great point. She said, you know, I sit down just to check up on something, right? 3 hours later, I realize I've just spent 3 hours doing right. that, you know, and I've heard mm-hmm. my wife say that. For me, it's email that does that, right? I say, I'm just going to answer this one email, and next thing I know, it's the next morning.
Because, it's easy to get sucked into it. I mean, yeah.
And mine's just work. I mean, forget about when you start even getting into the fun stuff.
This also affects young minds, the brains that are being developed. I think it encourages them to expect things to happen quickly, to if they don't get immediate response to something, that they move on. I think it encourages, it discourages them from going out into the real world and encountering something difficult and having to work hard at it. I also think we have a real modeling problem. If ever you go with a group of adults in a restaurant or a family gathering, everybody, all the adults are on their phone checking their phone, just like Jim is right now.
Yeah.
And it's a...
Jim is asking ChatGPT for a 200-word version of the report.
But kids see that.
I know. Can I ask, this whole idea about being online and the timing, I don't know. Maybe this is because I fight this war a lot. Of people say, oh, you're always on your phone. But I'm like reading a book. Or I'm looking at the paper, or I'm reading an article, so this is the mode of operation now for a lot of the information that we would be getting. You're not going to yell at a kid for reading a book. You're not going to yell at a kid for reading the newspaper. You're not going to yell at a kid, maybe even for playing a board game. But if they're doing it on their phone, that's suddenly like,
well, and that's again part of the challenge. So you know. Those people who are not listening to us live, who are listening to us at 3 o'clock this afternoon on either their phone or their computer, what are we going to say? You just wasted 2 hours? I mean, that's arguable, but they weren't doing something. So this is more focused on social media per se. But again, it's hard even to define. Sometimes what you mean exactly by social media. If kids are messaging to other friends who they are not physically located with. So in our day, if you went to summer camp, made a friend, right? You couldn't stay in touch with that friend every day. Now you can. Well, how healthy versus harmful is that? And is that social media? I mean, so again, these things sound very easy to say. They sound as easy as saying, hey, we have people out of work and we have people we should put to work. Let's just, you know, pass laws that say you have to work, right? I mean, when you look at this stuff for real, it is a complicated landscape. But what I do think is a crucial thing for parents to understand is that what's causing your kids to spend their time doing the stuff that has the most harmful results is the stuff where the advertisers who had restrictions on what they could do on radio had restrictions on what they could do on television now have no restrictions on what they can do on that social media. It's Instagram and TikTok and things like that. Those are not inherently harmful. And even spending time on that is not inherently harmful. What's inherently harmful is the way that the algorithms enforce what you're going to see. They help you choose what you're going to look at. And that's being influenced far more by a company paying for it than it is by, you know, sort of an AI system saying, hey, I think you'd be interested in this. That has its own problems. But it's really the fact that a lot of this stuff, you know, we hear a lot of talk about these big AI systems. We hear a lot of talk about big social media. Right now, all of that stuff is controlled by a very small number of super large companies. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not anti-large companies. But in general, we have learned historically that when things get too big, they need some regulation. And here we have five or six of the largest corporations in America that have zero regulation. Right. And that, I think, is where a lot of this harm comes from.
Tom writes to us and says, as someone who has worked in adolescent mental health for more than a decade, I can say with certainty that social media has altered the landscape for the worse. Bullying in particular has become ubiquitous, not only in frequency and scope, but in reach. It's also happening in real time. As a result, rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide have, in fact, skyrocketed. The data clear. Are there pros to social media? Sure, but the cons are dragging them down, and it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
I notice I did not disagree with that.
No, and you know, I think the flip side of that the bind that I would think I would be in, you know, my children are adults, so I'm on sort of the other end of it, is in this day and age, you know, it was a year ago with Uvalde, and this idea that you want to be able, because things are so different now and there are so many threats that these kids are facing, that you want to be able to contact your kids. So that almost you're in this, yeah, this horrible situation, mm-hmm, of saying, if I take it, you know, if I don't have a smart device that I can connect with my kids, that has significant downside. And now there's significant downside if they do have it, and this leaves parents sort of saying, what do I do? And again, I haven't read the entire document, but when I prepared for the show, it's ringing a bell, but it's not giving a lot of good guidance. Other than doing some goofy things that a lot of teenagers are going to roll their eyes at, oh, we're going to have a family media, what was it, family media plan, Joe? Was that what they, yep, what they, yeah, were calling for? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that'll go over real well.
All right. Let me go to some other letters. We have a few minutes before we have to take a break. Deirdre says, I also think it's a bigger issue than parents won't stay off social media. I see so many parents out in public with their families, parents completely engrossed in the phone, children see and follow suit. Then Margie says, as a parent educator, one thing I know is that the more you make something taboo, the more attractive you make it. Yeah. The way to help kids navigate social media is to build strong trust and connection with the child, model the behavior you wish them to emulate, be honest with them, and be open to learning with them. We must be the social media users we wish our kids to become, with apologies to Gandhi. Then
I think that's a very good point, and that's what I mean by the adults have to understand this stuff better.
I teach technology to elementary school students, writes Bill, and I've watched how this has affected our students. The social media companies are responsible. They hire addiction consultants to help design their systems. They know if they get the young addicted, they will stay and spend more money. Parents have an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm.
Then we check in with Carrie, who says parents should set an example for their kids and get off social media themselves. How can they ask their kid to self-limit when the parents are endlessly scrolling? I recently got off Facebook, and it has felt liberating. My close friendships have thrived, and I am meeting more people in my community. That from Carrie. And then we go to this letter. I am a father of three children, and there are plenty of parental controls available both on the phone and within specific apps. Is that enough?
Well, parental controls, like, you can't make in-app purchases. I agree. You know, and maybe they have it. That was my caveat at the beginning. Maybe things have gotten better. But I know when I, you know, first provided my child with a phone, it was around the safety issues, and it was also around transportation issues of, you know, call me when I need to pick you up from this practice or this after-school activity. And not being able to completely restrict access to the internet once they have a smartphone, it's either all or nothing. And so it's challenging. If you've got a data plan, they get access. And so that's a challenge.
What I will say is
30 seconds.
There are controls. They are not immediately obvious. And again, your kid, where parents are going to their kids to ask for help on setting up their computer, it's not surprising that
But kudos to that dad for figuring it out, and maybe that will inspire others to do the same.
Do look. A lot of these things do have controls.
We'll take a break. Be right back.
There's a wilderness of buildings that I swallow in the ground. They tie us to...
Before we get completely stop the conversation regarding online activity and what we look at and what we view and how we interact with social media, I really want to talk about the story about how the governor of the state of Florida, Ron DeSantis, will be announcing his 2024 run for the presidency of the United States of America on Twitter, pause, wait for it, with Elon Musk. Popcorn ready, let's go.
And using a Twitter feature that most people don't even know exist and don't even know how to use.
And what is that feature?
The audio. So you're used to Twitter giving you a short message, right? But you can also essentially, like on some of these other platforms, put on something where you can listen to a discussion or a long thing or something. So it won't be a 180, you know, 240 character something. It'll be a discussion. It'll be a audio.
But when you have you know, think about it though, Joe. It's actually kind of smart when you have the magnetism of a dust bunny. being on Twitter is probably the right platform for him. I mean, they can hear him, but they can't see him.
Well, and I think the other.
Are you talking about Elon or Ron DeSantis?
Yes, I am.
All right.
But I would point out at the risk of talking too much, the Twitter was Trump's tool. And when he got kicked off Twitter, that really hurt him. And in fact, if it wasn't for the media reporting what he has on Truth Social, no one would know.
Yeah.
I think DeSantis going after Twitter, which Trump is essentially boycotting, is a place where DeSantis thinks he may be able to beat Trump at his own game. I don't think it'll work, but I think that's what he has in mind.
I think this is a shot at Fox. I think, and Elon Musk wants to become the new Rupert Murdoch.
Well, that's true too.
Terribly unusual for someone to announce their run for president on social media or via a video. What is unusual is to have another person who runs that platform, Elon Musk, be side by side with him for some purpose. Even though Musk says he's not endorsing DeSantis at this point, although he's made it clear in the past that he likes DeSantis. That's unusual. I think Musk wants to be the new Fox, and with Fox's ratings down, with the departure of Tucker Carlson, I think the far right is really anti-Fox, maybe more anti-Fox than they are anti-Democrat at this point, and they'll do whatever they can to hurt Fox.
Ward Mayor.
I just want to say there are a few people out there who said DeSantis isn't going to run, and now I want to say I told you so.
Right. I mean, and that was like 2 weeks ago where they were saying, oh, all signs are pointing that he's just looking and he has time and he can do this in 4 years or 8 years. Yeah, no. I mean, you don't put that much. You don't do all the things he's doing and not run for president, right?
Yeah.
I think he just can't help himself. And I think that's, you know, when you've got these folks that see themselves as larger than life and bigger than anything else, they just can't help themselves.
Well, you do have to, the truth social things on my feed always come in via email. and he's at it again, and you can't, you know, Trump always saying these things. And you now, over the last 24, 48 hours, you've had to look to see whether he's complaining about Biden or he's complaining about DeSantis. And I just find that delicious.
This is great.
I thought DeSantis was waiting for the Florida state legislature to pass the law that said someone can be governor of Florida and run for president. And he'd been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. I'm not even sure that that's happened yet. But as he was waiting, he saw his numbers collapse in the polls. He, on the campaign trail, he has not been seen as a dynamic campaigner at all. He's seeing rising challenges from Scott from South Carolina, and at the same time, I mean, he's got this. He's been raising money. Clearly, he's been running, but right. It's a shadow campaign, and then doing all these crazy things, doing all these controversial far right things in Florida, like the Don't Say Gay bill, the 6-week abortion ban.
So bring that to Pennsylvania. Bring that to Ohio. Bring that to New Hampshire. How's that going to work?
I wasn't being offensive to Dust Bunnies when I made the comparison. I mean, his personality isn't carrying beyond the state. And even within the state, I mean, you know, he picked a fight with the state's largest employer, one of the state's largest employers, who just tanked $1.2 billion construction, and that's just the beginning. I mean, there's a whole lot of issues here. DeSantis feels to me like Scott Walker from Wisconsin, he had done all sorts of social engineering, messed up the state of Wisconsin, was the darling of the far right. He didn't even show up in any of the sort of downstate primaries. And I think that's what DeSantis is facing right now. I think that he could have a very, very short campaign.
You know, he's doing it at night, too. He's waiting late into the news cycle, wait, 7 o'clock or so, which most people would announce early in the day, and they would get the benefit of a day.
Before a holiday weekend, too.
Yeah, before Memorial Day weekend. So I'm suspecting that maybe he thinks it's not going to go well, and maybe he can spend. But the first day of your campaign, the campaign launch, is supposed to be your best day. I mean, we all remember Donald Trump coming down the escalator. He does, too. But but it seems to me like the timing.
Judy, the escalator remembers, too. He's not a small man.
He's missing the broadcast channels, nightly broadcast, you know, the CBS evening news. He's missing all those. He'll catch them in the morning newspapers. Surely we're talking about it all day today. But, again, the timing does not seem good. Maybe that's primetime Twitter.
But I don't know.
Fox,
we wrote off Freiburg. Trump when he rode down that elevator. It is impossible, I think, to predict what the far right will do, and anything could happen. And he has demonstrated that he will be really mean to people, the same way that Donald Trump was mean and demeaned people. He does a lot of the same things that Donald Trump did. So we shall see. But I don't. I predicted that he would run. What happens next? I think we need a little more time to tell.
Yeah, I mean, as one pundit I was listening to put it, anyone with a $110 million war chest has to be taken seriously.
Well, and with Trump too, is that it's not a bad strategy, and I thought Scott jumping in was not a bad strategy. You know, with all the legal issues that Trump is facing. There are so many variables that you can run a distant second right now and at the end be in front because the front runner was removed for a number of different reasons.
But DeSantis seems to be running to the right of Trump at this point. I think he's appealing to that base, because I think Trump is seeing some erosion in support among his base. I hear people say, you know, he supported, you know, he was in favor of those vaccines.
This is the Youngkin thing, right? Mm-hmm. So he's going to run far to the right until, and if he gets the nomination, then he's going to center and hope that everybody forgets all of the extreme positions.
And Elon Musk is not endorsing DeSantis. he said in the Wall Street Journal, I'm not. This isn't an endorsement. I'm just going to be there for the event. That's odd.
Is he the MC or something?
I guess he's the
interlocutor. I mean, arguably, CNN was not endorsing Trump when they gave him an hour of free TV time the other day, and the reporter. You know,
answered me, but that's a news organization. What is Twitter?
I understand what I'm saying. What I'm saying is Musk is trying to make that same claim.
Yes.
I don't think it's fair, and I think Musk has moved Twitter significantly to the right. There's been a lot of analysis of that.
And I think Judy, you put your finger right on a really important point, that this is an excellent opportunity to put a stake into Fox and to position Twitter as the voice of the right. Yeah. And regardless of what Musk wants to talk about as far as First Amendment and freedom of speech, some of the things that he has put out, some of the conspiracy theories, where he's putting his money, some of the statements he's made about work, and the way he's treated his own employees. Yeah. I mean, we as a country should be really concerned about Elon Musk.
Right. I think early on in his Twitter tenure, we underestimated him and we thought he was going to fail. He was going to break the platform, but he hasn't broken it yet. Even though no one in real life that I know is on Twitter, but what happens is the media picks up what's on Twitter and repeats it. I think they say 20% of American adults are on Twitter, but it's still an important 20% is millions.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us. You all are wonderful. Thank you very much. Judy Patrick, thank you. Jim Henler, always a pleasure. Bob Griffin, thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Mayor.
Lord Mayor.
Lord Mayor.
Lady Mayor.
It's really always a pleasure. I'm always humbled when you're here, and I thank you very much for doing it. Cool. Very nice to have you on the program. We look forward to having you back. We'll be right back with more right after this.